This is Views from the Watershed. I'm Lizzie Mogul, your tour guide. You are surrounded by forest just about everywhere you go in the Catskills. Trees as far as the eye can see. They look like they've been here forever. But these forests have been shaped, used, and managed for thousands of years by humans. In a sense, the forest is a kind of infrastructure, one that's interconnected with the infrastructure of the water system. Take a walk in the woods while you're listening to this episode about the past, the present, and the future of the watershed forest.
I'm Michael Kudisch, and I'm a forest historian.
Mike, you've been working for most of your life on deeply understanding and cataloging the Catskills Forest. How long has the forest been here?
There's certain tree species that have been here for 14,000 years, at least, and we know that because of the fossil record in peat bogs. Eastern hemlock was here, red spruce was here, balsam fir was here, yellow birch was here. Once these trees migrated in, they'll keep other species out. I mean, it's like, we're here, you stay out, you can't grow under our shade. So the forest hasn't changed in over 13,000 years in some of these places. There are, of course, a lot of tree species and plant species that have moved in since over the period of time.
So trees, like people, migrate from place to place. I guess trees just do it more slowly. Can you tell me about the human history of the forest? And let's begin with the Munsee Lenape people who were in the Ashokan Basin for thousands of years. How did they interact with and manage the forest?
You have all that repeated burning that the Native Americans did. And they increased the burning and the use of the land somewhere around 6,000 years ago. With forest fires, there would be two kinds of use. One would be agriculture, but that would have been only about 1,000 years ago starting. And they had the big maize cornfields just outside of Kingston on the Esopus Flats. And they would have grown other produce there in addition. They would have grown beans, squash, perhaps tobacco, and a whole bunch of other crops. In places where they did not farm, they would burn. Primarily for food, they were burning for a change in the forest. And they were burning to convert a northern hardwood hemlock forest into an oak, hickory, chestnut, walnut, butternut forest because of the nut production. And the nuts were eaten directly by the people. And the nuts were also favored by the wildlife that the people hunted. The number of species that have moved into the Catskills that otherwise wouldn't have been here if the Native Americans weren't burning, the abundance of them. That's why you have all these oaks and hickories and what used to be a lot of American chestnut around the Ashokan Reservoir.
And then Europeans came in, and then Americans, and displaced Native peoples from their ancestral lands. Instead of using fire to manage the forest, they cleared the land to make way for agriculture and animals.
Most of the interior of the Catskills was settled after the American Revolution. You had this heavy settlement. In the early years of settlement, the farmers would have taken just what they needed for firewood, for building houses and barns. The best land, generally on the valley bottoms, the floodplains, and places around the barns and the farmhouses, would be where they grew their crops. Most of the land that was cleared by the Europeans was used for pasture, and the pastures went much farther up the slopes. The forest had to be removed as a result of European settlement.
And you can still see traces of this today, right?
It's pretty easy today to walk up a mountain and just tell exactly where the pasture ended. And then above that, on the highest peaks, you have what I call the upper logging limit, and above that is original growth forest.
So after the initial settlement of the Catskills, there was a kind of industrial period with the logging and tanning industries, the acid wood industry, and production of specific things like barrel staves.
The tanneries were first, concentrated primarily from about 1810, 1820, through the end of the Civil War, when they started barking up the slopes. It would have been the first time many of these slopes had been ever utilized by people.
Tanning uses tannic acid derived from hemlock and other tree bark to cure animal hides into leather. Newspaper accounts of that time describe enormous hemlock trees, 4 to 6 feet in diameter and up to 125 feet tall. But the tanning industry decimated the hemlock forest in many places.
What would happen is that the hides of animals would be shipped up by boat from South and Central America and up to the major Hudson River ports, such as Kingston and Catskill. Then the hides would be loaded on wagons and hauled into the Catskills to the tanneries, which were built along the major streams. And the bark peelers would go out into the woods and peel the bark off the hemlock trees in the spring. But they'd leave the bark in the woods in piles and then come back in the winter and build the bark roads and bring the oxen up there and sled the bark out of the woods to the tannery. That's why the bark roads are only 4 feet wide. They're one ox wide. After the Civil War ended, the tanneries closed, so by 1880 or so, there were hardly any left.
And what about the logging industry?
You would have had the lumber companies, which would have moved in more toward the end of the 19th century. And they're not clear-cutting. They're selecting their trees. Very different from the acid wood industry, where they needed small trees and they would more or less clear-cut. So you have people moving farther and farther up the slopes of the mountains in the 19th century, gathering wood for construction purposes. Not only New York City, but the metropolitan areas, there were river drives on both branches of the Delaware where they were rafting logs down Philadelphia, but a lot of it was used right here. The wood products industry, where they were using large trees for making lumber, for building houses and hotels, they built furniture, chairs and desks, doors, flooring. Those forests were pretty much left to grow back on their own.
And a lot of those forests did grow back. Logging is still done now, but in a very different way. In the New York City watershed, the ultimate goal for the forests is maintaining water quality. I wanted to learn more about this interaction between forests and water and humans.
My name is Jessica Alba. I'm the Watershed Forest Stewardship Educator at the Watershed Agricultural Council, or WAC.
So why are forests important for the watershed?
Forests are critical in a watershed. They're the best type of landscape to protect your drinking water because forest soils and trees and vegetation is really good at filtering pollution out of water. And then also just loose sediment, so the dirt that can wash away during rainstorms, the erosion that you can get. The roots of a forest act kind of like a net underground and they hold it in place. So it allows water to pass through, but keeps the particulates back. And what's carried on those particulates would be the things like phosphorus and nitrogen, excess nutrients that can come from farms or other land uses. The trees can then use those nutrients to grow. So they're preventing it from reaching water at the same time. If you want clean drinking water, you want trees.
Who are the stakeholders of the watershed forest?
Probably everybody, even if they don't realize it, has some sort of investment in our local forests. But the folks that are particularly invested would be a lot of the landowners. So that includes public land like the state and the DEP, various towns and counties. And then most of it is privately owned. A lot of it is just family forest owners. Also people who use those public lands. So people who go hiking and boating, fishing and hunting. Those would be another big stakeholder. And then non-human stakeholders would, of course, be anything that's living in the forest. So all the flora and fauna, all of the trees, our wildlife, all of those depend on those forest lands for their habitat, their food sources, spaces to raise young.
So there are different perceptions and value systems at work here.
Yeah, there's a lot of ways that you can value the woods. And some of those ways you can put a dollar amount onto them. A lot of ways you can't, like just the enjoyment of a landscape. There are people whose livelihood depend on using forest resources. And as people who live on this planet, we must consume things to survive. But we're intelligent enough to try to do that in a way that's sustainable and ethical. Forest is also expensive to own in New York. So we've got really high property taxes and we don't want people to feel economic pressure to be forced to subdivide and sell. Once you lose forest land, it becomes difficult to bring it back to a forest. And then losing forest permanently, we know would be bad for water quality. We want people to know that logging their land is an option to make money off of it. People oftentimes conflate timber harvest or logging with deforestation, which is the complete removal of a forest. But most people who harvest their timber allow that forest to regrow. I think it's a great option to use the forest for economic reasons and to be able to take materials and resources from it, especially when that allows the forest to stay a forest.
To keep a forest healthy, it's a long-term project, right?
We call forest management managing your 100-year garden. So if you think of your backyard garden, you go in every season and you'll pull weeds and you'll plant things intentionally and you'll maybe reshape things so that you can achieve your goals for your garden. And a forest is kind of like every season being 30 years or so.
So some of what you do is to help people manage their part of the forest so that the trees can thrive.
A big part of my job is actually planting trees. We do a couple of different programs that can get landowners free native trees. We plant between 200 and 300 trees a year. You really want to get them growing up. They reach a certain height and size and their odds of survival are greatly increased. So we're trying to help those trees make it to adulthood.
I think the perception of the Catskills is that most of the land is owned by government, either by the state in the Catskills Park or by the New York City Department of Environmental Protection with the watershed lands. I was really surprised to learn that actually private land is the majority. So if you're a new landowner, how do you learn how to manage your forest? Well, you could visit a model forest. There are four of them in the Catskills and Hudson Valley. So I went to talk to somebody who has been involved with a model forest since the beginning.
My name is Rene Germain. I'm a professor at SUNY ESF. I teach forest operations. The New York City watershed is unique. First of all, it's 87% forested, and 71% of that forest is owned by private landowners. We call them family forest owners. And that's the target audience for the model forests, to demonstrate what they could do on their properties. What we're trying to do on a model forest is demonstrate good forest management and best management practices, both which are really important to maintaining water quality in the New York City watershed. We're trying to get people to be good stewards of their forest lands, to think about their role in water quality. And the 9 million people that get clean water, courtesy of these people in the Catskills, if people can't maintain forest management, then they start looking at other ways to generate income, and which often is parcelization and development. Parcelization is people taking 100 acres and subdividing it into 25-acre lots, or even worse, 10-acre lots. The average parcel size in the Catskills now is 13 acres. For every new parcel, you get a certain amount of square footage of impervious surface area. So you think of the forest as a sponge, and you take away that sponge and you put in roads, you put in buildings, driveways. That's water that isn't going to soak into the forest or the soil, and there's going to be erosion. So that trend of parcelization and development is not going to be good for water quality in the future.
So what kind of strategies can the model forest and foresters themselves help landowners figure out?
Different landowners in different economic brackets are going to have different landowner objectives. Some folks are going to manage for wildlife or wilderness, and they don't want any cutting. A lot of them are really interested in hunting. They want to promote deer habitat. Some of them want to maintain recreational trails, maybe go birding. But they all want the woodlot to pay its way. They get their tax bill and they go, geez, how am I going to pay my taxes? And then the next thing they do is they look at the woods and go, well, is there anything of value in my woods? That's where the forester comes in and sit down at the kitchen table. Let's see what we can do, how much money you can maybe generate from a particular harvest.
One of the challenges in stewarding forests seems to be about time. We humans have a very different time scale than trees do.
Land tenure is anywhere from 13 to 17 years. So it's really hard to get people to think about forest management, which is a long-term proposition. This is northern hardwoods, and us foresters think in terms of rotations of 80 to 100 years. It takes a certain landowner that has a stewardship ethic, that thinks about the future beyond themselves. The Native Americans think about seven generations. We don't do that. We think in quarters, profits, and that kind of stuff. And it's not embedded in the way we do things. Those city lands, they're not going to get parcelized. Any kind of government land, whether it's city, state, federal, or national forests, you know that the landowner isn't going to change. And you can really think long term.
So how does New York City think about the watershed forests on this longer time scale?
My name is Charlie Lang, and I'm the Forestry Program Manager with New York City DEP's Source Water Protection Programs. I have a staff of 11 professional foresters, and our charge is to manage the city's watershed forest for best water quality protection.
How much forest does the city own?
So 35,000 acres or so is the reservoirs themselves. So we own just over 140,000 acres of land in the watershed. Of that, just over 120,000 acres is forested. That's a small portion of the watershed land area.
What is forest management, and how does the city approach it?
Forest management is you're manipulating the forest for those desired goals. Good forest management is doing it in a way that is protective of the resources that you have around you. We're very protective of our resources. We're not doing it for money or for habitat. We are doing it for water quality. A lot of the things that we do under this water quality goal are also good for habitat and biodiversity, but also for carbon sequestration. The mechanism we use for our forest management is commercial timber harvests. I think one of the benefits of doing it this way for the watershed is that the loggers that bid on the job, the mills, they're all fairly local. And so there's an economic benefit there. That supports a healthy small-scale timber economy. There is good wood coming off our projects, can be made into some long-lived products that helps with carbon storage. The firewood has value, and obviously there's a good solid market for that in the Catskills. People use it a lot. My team of foresters, every year we design and develop usually about half a dozen new forest management projects. We go through a very intensive review process with all our in-house DEP experts. We do acoustic monitoring for rare and endangered bats, and that influences how we do the timber harvesting. We have our own wetland delineators that come out and delineate every tiny little wetland on the project area to make sure that we don't impact those during the harvest. We set up special management zones around wetlands and stream resources and reservoir buffers within which you have limitations on how much you can cut and equipment usage. On average, we're harvesting less than 1% of our holdings each year. We're harvesting the trees in a very sensitive manner. Mostly thinning the trees, we're taking out unhealthy trees, as well as some good timber trees, and creating gaps and opening up the canopy a bit. A lot of our forest lands, it's mostly mature, closed canopy forest. That's great, but for it to be sustainable in the long run, we really need a little more structural and species diversity. So you've got acres that are very young forests with seedling growth coming up, and then you've got patches that are saplings and pole-sized timber, and then you've got mature trees, and maybe you've even got patches that are really quite old that you're going to protect. If parts of our forest have those old-growth characteristics, we're going to identify that as a biodiversity hotspot, and we're not going to do any management there.
What are some of the challenges in managing the watershed forest?
We're getting all these invasive species coming in that are impacting and pushing out native species and impacting the ecology and the ecosystems. And so we have to step in where we can to try and mitigate the impacts.
So this includes plants like knotweed and stiltgrass and barberry, and insects like spongy moth and woolly adelgid and the emerald ash borer, which have all made their way through the Catskills forests.
Right, emerald ash borer is present pretty much throughout the watershed at this point in time. The likelihood is that 98-99% of the ash trees are going to be dead in a few years, which is terrible. Ash is an important component of the forest in some places. We've had to go in to harvest the ash before it's completely dead and rotten. While it still has value, it's kind of sad, but instead of the ash just dying and falling apart, we're able to create little patches and maybe some better habitat for some other tree species in a more controlled manner. We're trying to identify lingering ash. Maybe there's one or two that are still somehow holding on. Maybe they have some genetic ability to withstand or make them unpalatable to the emerald ash borer. So we're doing whatever we can to try and retain ash in the forest.
And deer are also an issue for forests.
Oak's an important component of the forests, particularly around the Ashokan Basin. But the big limiting factor for oak regeneration around here is deer browse. The deer numbers are way too high because there's no natural predators and they prefer oak seedlings. So if you make a nice opening in your forest and your oak seedlings start to germinate, they will wipe that out. One of the ways we can overcome that is to overload the deer with seedling growth so that the deer can't possibly browse everything down to the ground. And that seems to have been working.
To get a better sense of what DEP forest management actually looks like, I went on a walk with Charlie through a project by the edge of the Ashokan Reservoir that had recently been thinned out through logging.
These woods go right down to the shore of the Ashokan, which is, you know, one of the jewels in the crown of the city's water supply, a terminal reservoir for the Catskill system. This is a good site for pine. It's dry, it's rocky. You're actually seeing this a fair bit of regeneration, small pine trees all dotted through the understory here. That's great. Generally not preferred or browsed by the deer, so they should be pretty successful. There's a lot of thought that goes into that individual tree selection. That's my forester's specialty. They want to promote healthy trees and a good mix of trees on the site. So they might thin out poorer quality stems around a good quality tree. They'll also mark trees that are sick or unhealthy, like that bigger pine tree. I mean, it's almost got no needles. They might mark a whole patch of trees in order to open up an area. There will also be good timber in there as well. Maybe you'll have a patch of four good-sized oak trees, and you'll take three of them out, which will be good saw timber for the logger, but it will also mean that the one that you leave behind will really flourish and will spread out and become really nice, long-lived oak tree, hopefully. We want to facilitate biodiversity. We will leave habitat trees, nice big old snags that have lots of holes and cavities for various bird species or animals. That big old white pine, that's a great habitat tree. So that's another factor that goes into their thinking. Quite frankly, I'm amazed they just don't stand and get caught up with, oh my God, there's too many decisions here. In many ways, we're trying to reproduce natural processes. If we had all the land in the world and we could just let nature take its course, that might be nice, but obviously we've been manipulating the forest for a very long time. All those historic land uses have impacted what we see now.
What would happen if you didn't manage the forest?
Why not just leave it all alone? We've acquired or inherited primarily a relatively even-aged closed canopy forest. For long-term forest health and forest cover, that's risky because we're losing diversity of species. If we left the forest to its own devices, unfortunately, because as humans we've manipulated the environment so much, we would risk losing that forest in places. So that's the primary reason why we have to come in and do what we can to increase that diversity in those different ways for long-term water quality protection. All foresters understand that it's a long-term plan because it takes a while for these forests to grow. We are here for a short time. This forest is around for much longer than that, and there'll be plenty of foresters after me, and there were plenty of foresters that came before me. We've acquired these lands, and they're protected in perpetuity for this one primary purpose. So we are thinking very long timescales.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Views from the Watershed. Learn more about this program at walkingthewatershed.com/podcasttour.